This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we are live. Isn't it good to be alive?
Today it is.
So welcome to Jennifer Unter. What a great honor it is for me to welcome you here. And before I forget, I am Mel Rosenberg, the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network.
And I'm Jennifer, really happy to be here.
I'm not sure you'd be happy to be here. We can hear the airplanes going by here near Tel Aviv.
True.
Not that things are too terrific in New York, but anyway, I would trade places with you for a fortnight or so.
I'm sure.
And Jennifer Unter of the Unter Literary Agency. And tell us about what you do and wave a few books around. It's wonderful to have you on the program. And I have I was going to say a dozen zillion questions to ask.
Okay, I'm ready. I am thrilled to be here. I think this is a great program, and thank you for asking me to come on. I'm happy to show some of my recent books that have just come out. Here's one. Oops. Let's Read Animal Words came out from, I'm really not doing this well.
Yes, you are.
Okay. Watching it go off the side. So like fun word kind of
Spend a few seconds. Tell us.
Oh, okay.
About the book.
This one, it is really about teaching kids how to read and in a way that is very visual. So like there's a horse with, you know, the H as the horse itself, and flamingo obviously looks like a flamingo, and written by a Korean author who wanted to help his children learn how to read English.
Oh.
G. Lee is his name.
And he was illustrated by?
Oh, he illustrated himself.
Ah, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. And another one is That Monster on the Block, which is written by Sue Gann Schmidt and illustrated by Luke Flowers. They have another one coming out. This was published by Amazon, and it's really cute and fun and all about how a clown moves into the monster town, and they don't understand what a clown is, and they're really suspicious that he's not who they are. But they learn that he's actually, you know, a great guy. Good message for learning about people who are different from you, which we all need to. We all need to do that. This is just came out a couple years ago, but of course it was Diwali.
And we can wish everybody happy Diwali while we're here.
Exactly. Diwali was yesterday. And this was written by Courtney Pippin Mather and her sister-in-law, Sanyukta Mather. And it's beautiful, all about the holiday of lights and what they do to prepare and get ready and celebrate with their whole family and what they eat. And it's this great, beautiful spread of what the holiday is like. And that came out from Henry Holt, and they have a new book coming out about Holi, the holiday, next year. Here's another one. It's called Flip Floppy, and it is about a Kenyan dhow that was made from plastic. And this is a true story. And the author is Linda Raven Lodding, and she wrote it with Dipesh Pabari, who lives in Kenya, illustrated by Michael Machira Mwangi. He was also lives in Kenya. And it is just a gorgeously illustrated story of how these plastic flip-flops ended up on a beach. And they figured, well, we need to do something with this. So it's a great story of recycling and upcycling and learning what to do with all the plastic that, you know, we have, unfortunately, in our oceans. And they ended up with this gorgeous boat. And actually, King Charles just went to visit them and learned about what they're doing there. So that is amazing, too. Oh, my God, I got to get this.
It's good. No, because Jennifer, we don't want to show too much.
Yeah.
And when you have like new picture books coming out, please introduce me to the authors, the illustrators.
Okay.
I'd love to interview them as well. But
great.
This gives a little window on the type of people and books that you're representing. And sometimes, you know, when I see agents say, we want to hear from all over the world, we want to hear diverse voices, but sometimes I really ask myself whether they really mean it, or maybe they mean it, but they don't do it. Because agents usually gravitate to people who are very similar to them, like all of us, I suppose. But you're really, you're really taking on international projects.
You know, I try. I wish I did more, to be honest. I feel like there is not enough about people who we don't know about. And I think that's what, you know, unfortunately we end up with today is a lot of hatred for other people because they don't know who those people are. So when you're a child and you learn about things that you don't know, then there's empathy and there's, it fosters a feeling of, I want to know about this celebration or this person or this group because it's different from mine. And I think if you look at what's happening in the U.S. with the book bans, what do you think that's going to help people? No, it doesn't help people. It hurts in the end because then you're more insular and you feel like when you're a child, I don't know about that person who lives in, you know, wherever, Korea or Africa or Israel. And so I don't like them or I don't know them because it's not me. So I think the more we can do that, then obviously the better humanity is.
Well, as somebody who grew up in a small city in Canada and was subjected to quite a lot of anti-Semitism, from friends of mine in high school, who, when they found out I was Jewish, they said, how could you be Jewish? You know, you Christ killer, you. So if there were more books about the good Jews and the goodness of the Jewish people, maybe people would understand that we deserve to be loved and not vilified.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, so we have to do something about that. In the meantime, we'll get back to this. You had a career as a lawyer in corporate law, and you worked as an editor. And as my mom, my late mother would say, what is this mishigas of being a literary agent? I was born.
Okay. Well, it was a circuitous trajectory to get to where I am, which is actually, you know, it's fine. And I'm happy because it melds a lot of things that I love. I was an English major in college. And
Jennifer, go back. You haven't listened enough of my interviews. I want to know why you're stuck at the age of 5. Come on, start at the beginning.
Okay. I grew up in New Jersey with parents of, my mom was from Brooklyn. My dad was from the Bronx. So very New York, Jewish parents. But they ended up in Jersey because they wanted some land for their children. And, was, you know, a lovely suburban childhood and, ended, you know, with my parents not really sticking around, but that's okay. We don't have to go there. Then I ended up going to college.
Let's go there for a moment because what do you mean they didn't stick around?
Oh, my parents, my point is, I think they missed being in New York, and my dad ended up moving back to Manhattan. My mom's still in Jersey, though. So I think, you know, when you want to do something for your children, like move to the suburbs, and it's not exactly what you want, is it the right thing? Who knows?
There's a story here.
Yeah, there's a story there. There's always a story, right?
Yeah.
That's part of the reason why I didn't want to move to the suburbs. I think I, you know, wasn't.
But you grew up there until what age?
I moved, you know, after college, I moved home for about 6 months and then moved to Manhattan. So I would say till I was, you know, 21 and then moved into the city. And I'm not in Manhattan anymore. I'm in the Bronx, but still in New York City. And went to college in the Midwest, which was great, and had a different experience living in a place that wasn't New York at all. And, you know, you think...
Yeah, by the way, there are such places, you know.
I know. And you're like, ooh, everybody's slower. I mean, it's a different pace, and it was actually great to just live in a different part of America because we have such a big country, and the reality is so much of America is different and diversified and places that you don't experience when you grow up, obviously, in one area. And I moved back home and then moved into Manhattan and started working at a publishing house. I worked at Henry Holt for five years.
What did you study in college?
Oh, I was an English major. Yep.
Were you a writer? Did you write things or you just...
You know, I did. I published a couple of small things, one in journals, and I thought I wanted to be a writer. And I think I just don't have the patience. You know, you really need to like sit down and spend the time and not be distracted by things. And I, you know, I still write a little bit, but I don't have that hours and hours and hours in me. And it took me a long time to figure that out. And also I think, you know, when you work in this industry, you read your clients and other writers and you're like, well, they are so much better than me at this. So I'm good at this part. I'm not so good at that part. And that's actually, you know, it's good. And I think I'm also, I learned as an editor at Henry Holt that I was an editorial assistant, that I'm not a great editor either. I think, you know, I can edit and I can read things that I think, well, this should, you know, be changed or we're missing something here. But the very like detail minutiae, I get impatient with that too. So I think it was a good way to learn what you don't want, right? That's what you figure out when you're working is, well, this isn't for me. I loved it. I love my boss. I had a great boss named Alan Peacock, and he taught me a ton. It was a great place to work. At the time, it was not owned by Macmillan, so it was very homey, and Bruno Quinson ran it, and he knew everybody's birthday. And while I was there, it started to get more corporate. It was bought by Holtzbrinck. And they brought in, you know, a different CEO and a new head of editorial. And then editorial assistants were not allowed to go to the editorial meetings anymore. So it just kind of got like a little bit, you know, like, oh, I see where this is going. And I went to work for a literary agent. I went to work for Barney Karpfinger, who... I learned so much from him too. I worked there for 4 years, I believe. I worked at Holt for 5 years. I worked at Barney's for four-ish.
Hold on a second. But when you work as an editor, you get a salary.
Yeah.
Most literary agents get percentages.
Yes. Well, for Barney, I was salaried because I wasn't doing deals. So there was no, it wasn't commission based. I was working just salary based. I was helping him. He was amazing at contracts and I learned more from him doing contracts than I did going to law school, which is, you know, another story. But he taught me a ton, and I actually worked for Liv Bloomer, worked there, and she used to run sub rights department at Warner Books when it was Warner Books, and I learned a ton from her on the foreign side. So I was salaried, and I did domestic subsidiary rights. So I sold audio, audio wasn't even big then. I sold for Serial, which still happened, and for decent money. And I helped her with foreign. So it was not a commission-based job. And I was going to law school at night. So my last year at Henry Holt, I was in law school at night and then worked for Barney and was rushing off and going to law school. And then when I graduated law school, I went to work for an entertainment law firm.
But as a lawyer? Copyright law.
Correct. Yes, I did.
Lawyers make a serious salary.
Yeah, I made money, but I didn't like it. I was really unhappy. Even though it was a small boutique law firm, it was such a different vibe than working in publishing. You know, you had to account for your hours. You had to work late. You had to take on things that you didn't necessarily want to and learn, you know, it was great because I learned copyright. I learned trademark. I learned how to draw up an agreement and what to do in a dispute and all that. And it was actually a great
experience. And you learned that you spent 5 years studying something that you didn't want to do.
I know.
No, but I mean, most people, including people dear to me, are lawyers who they got used to, you know.
Yeah. Make money, and you think, I could stay here. But I think my issue was, and even in a small boutique firm, there was one female partner, and I looked at her life. She had small kids, young kids. She was at work all the time. And I thought, I want that. That's not what I want my life to be. You know, I want to have a career, but also be a mom. And it just was not appealing. And I think when you go from a career in publishing where they really do, you know, despite the fact that it's low pay, they really do try to give you some, you know, sense of independence. Like, you should go and look for this author. Like, when you're a young editor, you're told, go out and read everything you want and see if that person wants to write a book. It was also a different time, you know, so you weren't like on social media all the time looking in that way. You were actually reading. So they gave, it was a sense of independence. Whereas at the law firm, it was like, you're beholden to us and you have to stay here. And I don't care what your life is. You're just sitting here until this is done. And people just, you know, when you're low on the totem pole, they just shove all this work at you. And that's how you're supposed to learn. And it's fine if you love it. But I just didn't love it enough to deal with it. And I really missed publishing. And I missed the agency side. You know, it was exciting because when you're an agent, you're not only you can look for the projects and you can make the deal, which is exciting and innovating, but also you can do the editorial side too. You read a proposal and you're like, oh, this isn't quite where it needs to be. I can make this better and then send it out, and somebody else can actually, you know, do the nitty gritty editing. So it seemed like a perfect meld for me. And I went to work for an agency that was called RLR. It's no longer around. And they did most of the employees there were on the sports side, but they had a publishing arm. And the person who ran it was leaving. So I was in charge of, I think there was like 50 clients. And so it was like, I was thrown in, and it was great. It was a great experience of learning and figuring out what to do. I mean, there was a lot of like backlog work that I had to do and get up to speed on these authors who, you know, I didn't know and didn't know what their books were. But I could bring in my own, and it was great.
Then you started your own.
And then I started my own. Well, I got fired. I know. It's okay. I don't. You know, it actually another life. I mean,
but you can tell a story. You know.
It was a good story. Yeah, it was a good story. It was actually, I think, you know, somebody who worked there did not love me, and I had the bigger office, and they. Didn't like that. And so, you know, I had young kids and I was closing my door to pump, you know, it was like, it was a weird time and not a great place to be a woman who was, you know, trying to juggle a life and career. And so I ended up getting fired. And the best thing that happened, because it was a very easy place for me to work. I was, you know, I was in charge and I had people working for me and I had a nice salary and I had benefits and then I had nothing. And I thought, I have to make something here myself. I don't need to I don't need somebody to tell me what to do. I can figure this out. I mean, when the week I got fired, my husband said, you're starting your own agency, because I've been talking about it. I had a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And he said, you don't need to go back to work. You should start your own thing. And I applied for an LLC that week. So, you know,
which you knew how to do.
He knew how to do. Well, I knew how to do because I was a lawyer, but he knew how to do it even more because he started his own company. So it was, he was very helpful. And
how many years has it been?
So that was in 2008.
Wow. So you have now your own company for 13 years.
Yep.
And I'm sure at the beginning there's nothing coming in, then slowly things come in and you've grown up.
Yeah. Well, it was probably the worst time to start anything. If you remember 2008, it was like the crash.
Jennifer, there's never a good time.
There's never a good time. I mean, people could say now is a terrible time. I'm sure.
Another story.
Yeah, exactly.
So now the question is, now we can get to a little bit of nitty gritty here. I love agents who concentrate on children's literature. You'll have to, in a paragraph, tell us why you concentrate on children's literature and a lover of picture books. Yay.
Yay. I know. I think because there's such joy in doing this and you kind of get a message in a very short period of time, you know, really distilled and it's usually beautiful and it's usually fun and it's usually meaningful. And so you get all that in one very small little package. And then there's, you know, the illustration on top of it, which I don't represent illustrators. I represent a couple of author illustrators, but, and then, it, you know, you have this, the text, and then you see the illustrations come in and the sketches and you're like, wow, this is really, it's joyful in a way that I think adult publishing is not always joyful. I do both.
Do you realize how much angst there is for us authors?
Yes, I know.
another agent has been on the show and say, I'm not going to name names, but also another favorite of mine. And he says, it's all about joy.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, oy vey.
Not all joy. About
me. Oy vey, this joy.
I know. It's angsty. Everything is angsty. And publishing is not an easy, obviously not an easy profession. Writing is not an easy profession. There's, you know, even when you have a book published, there's not. Yeah. So you look at your royalty statement, right? And you say, what? Well, how is this possible? It only sold, 3,000 copies and the publisher's not doing anything about it. And, you know, yes.
Yeah, but those, we're talking now about the 1 in 1,000 authors that gets a publishing deal. So we're going to go back there in a moment. But I'm going to ask you now what I ask all the people I interview, which is, are you a 5-year-old at heart?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm a 5-year-old.
I certainly don't know. You have to tell us.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's, I definitely can tap into my inner child, but I'm also really type A. So I don't think many 5-year-olds are type A. I work a lot and I'm super organized and, I think I can reach into a feeling of this is what I think kids would like. And having children.
Hold on. What, Jennifer, I'm going to stop you now.
Yeah. Okay.
What kids will like. But at the beginning of our conversation, you talked about what kids need.
Mm.
And when I was, let's say, because I'm older, way back in the day, picture books were more message driven.
Yeah.
And it was okay to write the message first and the story later. Today, the authors are taught No. Write a good story.
Yeah.
But now I'm really wondering. So shine a little light here, please.
I think you need both. Yeah. You need to have the story that has a message that children want to read again and again and again because it's fun, but that they understand, well, when you throw books around, that's not the right thing to do. Or when you you aren't nice to your friend, that is maybe you should go talk to them after. You know, so there's, I think when you have both is when you really hit the sweet spot. And it's hard to do. It really is. You know, I have a lot of authors who, apart from my picture book authors, I have other authors who are middle grade or young adult or even adult. And they say, I wrote this picture book. And I read it and I'm like, you need to go and read like 35 picture books and then come back to me and tell me you wrote a picture book, because you're writing something that is too didactic and not, you know, something that kids are going to love. And then we're getting nowhere with this. So it's very difficult, as you know.
Jennifer, if somebody sends you a manuscript, it has this amazing, brilliant story. Okay. While we're talking, I'm thinking about my favorite book growing up, which was Madeline by Ludwig Bemelmans. I'm hard pressed to find the message here. It's an incredible story. Isn't it okay to write a wonderful story and then let the chips fall where they may and read a response and death of the author, and let the kids figure out their own message and the parents?
Yes. I'm looking to see if I have a yeah. So here's an example. Meowloween, super story about a kitty on Halloween who is in with all, you know, the children, and the young cat gets lost in the scrum with the kids, and then the mom finds him. Not a story, you know, just a cute book. And I mean, not a message, just a story. And I think, you know, it works because it's tied to a holiday. And when I saw this just came out in September, and, you know, in October, it was all over the place in displays, in bookstores that were doing Halloween displays. So it works because you have something to tie it to. So yes, it can work. It just, there has to be maybe something else that works with it, or that it's such a good story that nobody can turn it down, which is hard.
you've opened an Oy Vey Pandora's box here.
Sorry.
It's okay. So you said here, this is where the fun begins, Jennifer. You say, okay. So we agree that the story should be first and then the meaning and the inference. But then you say, okay, but you can have just a beautiful story, but it has to be marketable. It has to connect with the holiday, a something. And that's Oy Vey also, because then we go and then people are going to say that agents, when they read a story, they're looking for something that they can sell easily, not something that's beautiful.
Well, you have to have both. I'm sorry to say, you know, it's really, it's such a tough time to sell anything, really. I mean, look at publishing. It's like every week you read about book sales are down, book sales are down, book sales are down. After the pandemic, when book sales were up for two something years, it's been whew. So now publishers are reassessing and you know, gobbling each other up, as you know, too. And there's fewer publishers, although amazingly enough,
Jennifer, this business goes up and down and up and down.
Of course.
And people still have children.
Yes.
I don't know exactly how that happens, but the people have children and children need books. And you're selling books now anyway for 2026. or beyond. And probably things will rebound in some way or other.
Yeah.
And if I'm still having this, these conversations, we can connect in 3 years. We should both be healthy. And we'll say, as the industry rebounded. So let's be optimistic here. We can be both pessimistic about the world, but let's be optimistic about children's books and say that the world is going to rebound. It's still hard to sell a picture book.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is, despite the fact that you know, the big five have become even more corporate and they look for, you know, the next picture book that can become, you know, a Nickelodeon special. There's a ton of small publishers who have come up in the last, you know, 5 years that are picture book only. And they do beautiful books. And one of them is, you know, what I just showed here. Flip Floppy was Beaming Books. They do beautiful books. And there's a bunch of other ones that I can think of. And I've been really doing a lot of business with the smaller picture book publishers.
There you go, you see. So there are things happening. And even the big five, once upon a time, were little five. They were actually little 500 and they became the big five.
Exactly.
Every publishing house starts from somebody who was fired from another, you know.
I agree. The problem, and not that this is a problem, but the issue with the smaller publishers is they don't have a big, you know, publicity or marketing reach. So you really have to, as the author, decide that, you know, either that's okay with you and however many books sell, or that you're going to take that mantle on your shoulders and you're going to go out and do as much publicity as possible. And I have authors who do that and they go and do readings at schools and they do readings at libraries and they have a lovely career doing that. So it's not easy. I'm just saying, you know, there's nothing easy about this publishing life, really. It's not like, here, this is, we're handing you a bestseller. It never happens, but it can be rewarding and hopefully, you know, not as angsty as as other things.
Okay, a little bit more nitty-gritty now. Agents, like, you get thousands of submissions a year.
Yes. How do I wade through them?
Well, the odds are for an author are less than a 1,000 to 1. Usually, you know, an agent will get between 2,000 and 12,000 submissions a year, depending on how open they are. And except maybe 2 or 3 or 4 new people. If you're different, tell me.
Oh no, I get a ton. I get, you know, 30 a day, 40 a day. So is the question is, what do I do with them? Or do I look at them? What's the question?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Okay.
I mean, we have a lot of people listening who are aspiring authors. We all need good agents, you know, but, tell us what the secret is from the other side.
Yeah. So I would say, I do read my queries. I don't usually read them when I get them. I'll, you know, take a moment usually each day and read queries that I, you know, I missed a month ago, which is not great either, because sometimes those are gone, you know, another agent snapped them up, but I just don't have the bandwidth sometimes. So they get read usually, and I have talked to a lot of agents who they definitely all read their queries. I think the secret to getting somebody to request is, first of all, if another agent is interested, then, you know, you send your email out to all the other agents, say, I have an interested agent, then everybody seems to be able to read it in time. Or you do something like where I met you at the SCBWI Israel, Zoom where I then said after I did my presentation, whoever listened to this, you can send me your picture book and I will read it. So everybody who sent me a picture book, I still have them submissions because I haven't quite gone through them all, but I read every single one. And so when you do something like that, or you do another, you know, workshop in person, or, you know, I do these like Reader's Digest workshops where you're just like quickly meeting people, that's the way to be able to get your work read. And having, you know, other sort of, if you're a part of SCBWI, doing that either in person or on those Zooms, or, you know, they have weekend conferences, which I've been to also, another great way of meeting people in the profession. And it's just, you know, you have to kind of get out there and not just be at home writing. You know, once you think you have something that's finished, and hopefully you've workshopped it and had other people read it too, and you feel like you're ready to go out with it, then, you know, look at what's in your area, what conferences or Zoom meetings or writers communities. And that's how you should get, you know, meet people who work in publishing. And it doesn't even have to be an agent. It can be an editor. And sometimes I've had editors say, I love this work, but this person needs an agent. Can you read it? So it works that way too.
Okay. So this is going to be my last question, unless you have other questions. This is something that's been bothering me, and I've interviewed many agents, but you're the first one who gets the question. It's a very personal thing. And you obviously want to represent people that you feel you can work with. But usually, all you get is one story that is very easy to reject. Speak to me about being able to judge an author on the basis of one submission, or to look at a manuscript and say, oh, I'm not taking this, but you might not be taking this because you're not attentive to what it could be. Because sometimes agents will say to me, oh, Mel, this doesn't work for me, or the standard thing. And so once in a while, an agent will say, oh, you know, could you turn this into a into merry-go-round?
Right.
So how does that work for you? This is a quandary that I haven't figured out yet.
Yeah.
How do you get an agent to see beyond the single two-dimensional manuscript to see potential beyond that?
Yep. It's a good question because I ask myself that too. And sometimes I read something that I think, I like this, but it's not quite there, and I don't know how to fix it, or I don't want to know how to fix it, or I have no bandwidth to fix it, or any whatever. And I will ask that person, you know, when you have future work, please send it to me. So I try to leave it open. I mean, unless I read something that I'm like, well, this is awful, and I never want to read this person again. You know, I try to be open, and I have in the past. In fact, I have another one. This is an excellent example. So this Grandpa's scroll about a Korean girl whose grandfather dies, and she never gets to meet him. These authors I've been working tangentially with for years. And she initially, Ginger Park is the author. She sent me something and I said, and then she sent me something else and I said, and she sent me this and I'm like, this is great. And I sold it. And now we have two more picture books under contract. So
that's a wonderful story.
Yeah, it's a great story. And And in fact, she wrote a middle grade that I tried to sell, and I couldn't, but I thought it was great. But, you know, it was didn't hit the right note for people. So, you know, it is a process. And if an agent shows a little bit of interest in your work, then maybe you say, well, is it, you know, can I send you something in the future? And that's a way to kind of leave that door open a little. And hopefully most agents, I think, you know, if they see something in your work, then they're going to want to see something else that, you know, when once you've developed a little more as an author, nobody's the same after 2 years or 3 years or even 10 years. So I like to leave the door open, and it's worked out in the past. So, you know, I would say for authors who want to get their foot in the door, if an agent is, you know, giving you a nice rejection, then maybe say, I have other things. Can I show it to you, you know, at some point? And hopefully they'll say yes.
That's wonderful. Any other parting advice before I ask you about why you really do this?
Parting advice is, you know, there is a perseverance. There really is. You have to keep going with it. And my most successful authors are ones who get rejected and get rejected and get rejected and keep going. And hopefully have, you know, some success in the future. And I'll give you one more example. So this is another author who I've been working with a long time. Her name is Tracy Kyle. And Pepe and the Parade is a book that she wrote a while ago. And it's just exponentially, like at first it didn't do anything, and it just keeps selling. And so Little B is the publisher, and they just did a board book, and now they want another book. And so, you know, it does build on itself. And so even when it might feel like things aren't going so well, keep going and maybe think about a different way to sell your book in a way that, you know, if you don't love social media, maybe there's a festival near you, or maybe there's, you know, something that's a little different than what the publisher is doing. Think outside of the box, maybe, is my advice. I hate that saying, but.
Yeah, I teach my students to think between the boxes.
Right, exactly.
Jennifer, this has been wonderful. I'm going to just sum up that I think that what you're doing is what the Jewish people call a tikkun. And I want you to correct me. In other words, and this is something, you know, I know that you were both Jewish, and you, you know, you I heard you in your SBWI, you like Jewish stories. But my bone to pick is basically Judaism is not about the Chanukah that can't find the candles, or the matzah that thinks it's a hat. But it's actually about being a good human being.
Yeah.
And if we're going to make a plug for the Jewish people, let's do that. The most important thing in Judaism, and this is what is most understood, is that you don't have to believe in anything to be Jewish.
Yeah.
But if there is one thing you should do, it's to be a good human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I see when we started talking, and I've had some interactions with you, you want the world to be a better place through your work on children's books. Correct me.
No, I can't, because I think that is why I do what I do. It's not easy being an agent either. You know, you say it's not easy being an author. Believe me, I get rejection after rejection every day. And I have to just say, this is worth it. It's worth it. And you know, working with small publishers, you get small advances, but it's worth it. And I do think that, you know, what I'm doing is it's for a better world. I mean, it's reading, you know, people don't read enough. People don't talk to each other enough. People don't look at differences enough and appreciate differences. And so I think this is a way to do that, to get children to do that. And if they grow up understanding that, then you are helping humanity. So yes, I can't argue with you on that.
This is your tikkun.
Exactly.
Jennifer Unter, it's been a great joy. I would keep talking to you all day, but it's been 50 wonderful minutes. And I'm just going to say goodbye. We're going to go off and come back. So we'll do a little sum up, just you and me. And everybody else can be jealous, and they should be. I want to thank you so much for your generosity and your kindness. And you are a terrific person. You know, people sometimes demean agents, partly because they have to turn down 99.9% of their submissions.
Right.
And
right.
Whenever I interview an agent, I find a jewel. So
yeah,
you're right.
Thank you.
So thank you for what you do. And I'm going to sign off before I forget and say that my name is Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network here in Israel. And I've been talking to the wonderful literary agent, Jennifer Unter, who has her own wonderful agency, and she's in the Bronx, and she's open to submissions. Are you?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And if you should submit, you should mention that you saw us together, right?
Yes, that would be great. In the subject line of your email.
In the subject line. Well, does it get better than that? Jennifer, we're going to go and come. And thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Mel. This was amazing. Bye.